her say on TV. Now, they haven't repeated this since then, of course, but I heard him say, well, it looks like we're going to have to pull building number 7.
That's what they said. They said they were going to pull it, and you're not the only one that heard those words. And they tried to explain it afterwards, saying that pull meant something else, but evidently pull meant activate the detonation, the explosive devices that were obviously placed carefully within the girders of the building.
Yeah, a long time ago. And also, there's a show that, there's a local cable access show called 9/11 Was an Inside Job. It's on local cable access. It comes out on Portland Community Media, and it's on Channel 11, the first and third Saturdays of the month at 5 p.m., and it's called 9/11 Was an Inside Job.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got all kinds of proof and documentation on there. He has lots of times he'll have experts on there, either call in or actually be on the show. And there's actually an associated website you'll want to check out. It's called AE911 Truth, and it stands for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And there's over, I guess, a group of 700 or 800 architects and structural engineers in North America.
Yeah, if you want the truth, you need to go with the scientists who have actually studied the phenomenon. You have to avoid people like David Icke. You have to avoid people who have been placed there or encouraged to be prominent in the media so that they can put out ridiculous claims which are easily disproven. These are straw men. This happens every time that there is truth out there that is that the powers that be don't want to be accepted as legitimate, then you get these bogus men like Icke. But yeah, there is good information out there, and you just have to, you know, you have to do the work. You have to find out, do buildings fall by themselves? Has there ever been a building fire and that, you know, large skyscraper that caused an immediate collapse into its own footprint like a detonation? You know, of course, the answer, answer is no, but find that out for yourself.
Yeah, if you look back in history, there was a high-rise fire in Brazil and another one in L.A. back in the late 80s. And I know the one in L.A. burned for at least 36 hours, and the helicopter telephoto camera shot in there, and this thing looked like a kiln. I mean, it was just glowing red in two full stories about two-thirds of the way up on the building.
It's steel. It doesn't turn to dust.
No. And plus,
thanks for that. You know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I am actually out of time. I've run out of time, and you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO, and there is much more of the Incomparable Radio Zine coming up. So if you want the truth and you want the relevant facts, stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
Political Perspectives invites you to tune in to a Deeper Looks two-part special on modern slavery here in America and in Oregon. On Wednesday, August 26th at 9:30 a.m., join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, for Part 1, an interview with Kevin Bales, president of Free the Slaves and author of the new book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. On Thursday, join me for Part 2, a report on human trafficking here in Oregon. Who's enslaved here and what are we doing about it? That's a two-part political perspective special about modern slavery on A Deeper Look at 9:30 a.m. this coming Wednesday and Thursday mornings, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Per Fageren hosts Fight the Empire. He speaks with Rick Rozoff about the globalization of NATO. Rozoff has been involved in anti-war and anti-interventionist work in various capacities for 40 years. At 10, your Cascadia commentary and news with Liam Delta and Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a special report on the bloodiest day in Baghdad in 18 months, with over 100 people dead and 500 wounded. Also, American Casino, a new hard-hitting documentary by Andrew and Leslie Coburn on the subprime ripoff and how it worked. At 11, Krista Leedy will talk with David Masumoto about his newest book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land. At 11:30, you'll hear Movie Talk with Ed Goldberg. All that coming up this morning on KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. And now stay tuned for Fight the Empire.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring. Fight the Empire. Our guest is Rick Rozoff, who is been a peace activist for a long time. He writes articles that can be seen on the Global Research website, among others. Rick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Per. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, you know, we're going to talk about NATO, and I'm just thinking back about 20 years ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was talk about, there was talk about a peace dividend, which never happened. And there was talk of wonderment, what's going to happen to NATO, like they have no reason for being anymore. But that hasn't happened either.
No, it certainly hasn't happened. Quite the contrary. What we've seen is an expansion of a military bloc, which in, at the time you're referring to, 20 years ago, consisted of 16 countries. Now has 28 full members in various capacities, as many as 40 or 50 partners around the world. That's actually on five continents, as well as in the Middle East. You know, if I may, a former State Department official, Kurt Volker, who the year after he made the statement I'm going to relate to you, became U.S. ambassador to NATO, incidentally, stated in 2005 that the preceding year, 2004, NATO had conducted eight operations on four continents simultaneously. That's an amazing global span, and it has very little to do with the North Atlantic, you know, that gives the military bloc its name.
Well, maybe they should keep the North Atlantic in there because that's where the real power lies. They are the decision makers.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, there's something that's alternately referred to as the NATO Quad or the NATO Quint. In the first instance, it's the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. In the second, you could throw in Italy. But those are the five major military powers. And the new additions, you know, the 12 new countries in Eastern Europe that have been dragooned into NATO since in the last 10 years, you know, are minor players in this. They're to supply cannon fodder for wars and like that in Afghanistan. And to station, as today's news remarked, and I can talk about that in a moment, U.S. missile shield facilities close to the Russian border in Eastern Europe. So I refer to them as NATO's new military colonies. They're to provide troops for overseas wars and bases for the expansion of NATO and U.S. Military infrastructure eastward.
Well, let's look at some of the steps in this expansion. One was 1996, where the U.N., the U.S. kind of bulldozed the U.N. into dumping Boutros-Ghali.
I'm very glad you mentioned it. I just had a discussion last night here in Chicago with a friend of mine originally from Serbia who had read Boutros-Ghali's memoirs. And, of course, as you know, I mean, it's traditional in the United Nations for the Secretary General to be granted a second term. He was canned, as you mentioned, on the initiative of Madeleine Albright, who was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations at the time. And his story, and every other one I've seen tends to confirm it, is 14 of the 15 countries in the Security Council at that time supported his re-election as Secretary General. And the U.S. just quite candidly strong-armed the other nations into capitulating. And they brought in Kofi Annan, who...
kind of an amiable stooge.
Yes, as is his successor, Ban Ki-moon. Kofi Annan had been a special UN envoy to Eastern Europe, to the Balkans and NATO at that time. So, you know, he was a proven flunky or stooge, as you say. And that tradition has been continued. I mean, the United Nations in many ways has been subverted precisely in conjunction with NATO expansion. You know, my comments last night in the discussion I mentioned to you were the sacking of Boutros-Ghali. I think really signaled the effort by the major Western powers, the U.S. in the first instance, to supplant the United Nations with what is now routinely referred to as global NATO, 21st century NATO, expeditionary NATO. These are their own terms, incidentally.
Mm-hmm. What were, why didn't they like Boutros-Ghali?
Two reasons. He wouldn't give NATO, he wouldn't give UN authorization for NATO's bombing of Bosnian Serb positions in 1994 and 1995. And the official story is that while Boutros Ghali was away someplace, Madeleine Albright and, you know, the Clinton administration went to Kofi Annan and got his authorization, which I don't believe personally he was in a position to grant. So, he bucked the U.S. On the Balkans, but also he condemned the terrible atrocity in Qana in Lebanon, where the Israelis bombed a refugee camp and killed almost 200 people, and he wasn't to be forgiven for that either.
Well, and then we have the Yugoslav War of 1999, where the Security Council was basically ignored.
It was circumvented and spurned.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is another stage in the undermining and, you know, ultimately, I would argue, dissolution of the United Nations as an effective organization with the U.S.-led global NATO. And also, and perhaps we can talk about later, what's been referred to over the past few years as Asian NATO as a complement in the Asia-Pacific area. But three things happened almost simultaneously in 1999 that are worth recalling. There was the first NATO expansion in the post-Cold War, Cold War period, where Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, all former Warsaw Pact countries, were brought into NATO on the occasion of the 50th anniversary NATO summit in Washington in 1999. I, for one, believe at least the timing of the war against Yugoslavia was synchronized with those two events. It signaled the emergence of a global NATO. Anyone who remembers the television clips of that time with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair flanked by the leaders of some 50-odd countries, you know, NATO full members and partners, one could easily confuse that for a new United Nations. So you had three things happening simultaneously. You had NATO's expansion into the former Warsaw Pact. This is, of course, after James Baker supposedly told Mikhail Gorbachev in 1989 or thereabouts that NATO would not expand one inch eastward. We've now seen it go substantially, further east with 12 new members. The war against Yugoslavia, which is NATO's first war, you know, was a 78-day relentless bombing campaign, as you say, in circumvention of the United Nations and all international law. Afghanistan is now, of course, NATO's first ground war.
Well, you know, you could say the Yugoslav War was, this is a war that a lot of liberals supported.
Don't I know it.
Kind of liberal, the liberals' war. And it's sort of, you know, it's kind of something, I've always been kind of curious about that. I think a lot of liberals, they really want to be on the, you know, they want to be on the bandwagon, but they want to feel good about it.
You put that very eloquently. In fact, it was a Democratic administration, so, people who claim to be anti-war as a matter of principle, in fact, look at who's in the White House. Similarly with the Afghan war. It was Bush's war, of course. He launched the invasion in October 2001, but during the 2004 presidential campaign, it was very revealing. A number of political figures, Hillary Clinton was one, John Kerry was another. Al Gore, who early in the year, if you remember, was kind of floating the idea of running again for the presidency, demanded at that time that Bush expand U.S. troop strength in Afghanistan, which at the time was 12,000 troops, to 60,000. That would have been a quintupling of the troops, and it's revealing that they all had exactly the same figure, so that even a Republican war can be supported by Democrats. And, in essence, Bush was accused of not prosecuting the war aggressively enough. So what you have with the two major parties in the United States is it's not a question of what's right and wrong, but who's doing what to whom and who's sitting in the White House at the time. So you're correct about the 1999 war. You know, it signaled the beginning of a very short-lived public relations stunt called humanitarian intervention. And you've noticed you haven't heard the term in the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, and it is also this big propaganda war demonizing Slobodan Milosevic.
Yeah, precisely.
You could say he was kind of a ruthless guy in many ways, but, they were talking, he was like the new Hitler or something. Everybody's a new Hitler.
Well, thank you for raising that. I've commented on that in the past. is, you know, the Western establishment media and government officials are constantly finding new Hitlers around the world, and they have black, brown, white, and yellow faces. You know, everyone from Mugabe in Zimbabwe to, you know, at times Lukashenko in Belarus to formerly Saddam Hussein in Iraq and so forth. But while this is going on in NATO countries like Estonia, Latvia, now Croatia, you know, there's a revival of open neo-Nazism, where there are marches celebrating Waffen-SS veterans, statues erected to Nazi collaborators and so forth. So you see the genuine article emerge in countries that are both NATO and EU members. Nothing said about that as they're going around the world finding new Hitlers. Iran, I suppose, has provided the most recent one, right? And you know, when the when actual neo-Nazism arises, or rehabilitation of you know, Nazi-allied collaborators and so forth, it's not a word said in the Western media. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's been going on ever since the end of World War II.
Yeah.
You know, another interesting thing in 1999, NATO's focus went from being a defense alliance to protecting what it calls, quote, vital resources. That's a big leap right there, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. The current U.S. National Security Advisor, James Jones, he's a retired Marine general. And as a matter of fact, when he was, his name was first floated for that position after Obama's election last November, there were two newspaper articles. I believe one was Washington Post, the other was an Israeli newspaper, perhaps Haaretz. But almost simultaneously referred to James Jones as the new Henry Kissinger. And we have to keep in mind Jones had had previously been, it's a dual position, but he had been Supreme Allied Commander for NATO forces in Europe and the head of the Pentagon's European Command. These are, you know, one person gets both positions simultaneously. And he's the one who really engineered the development of the U.S.'s most recent military command, Africa Command. And he spoke repeatedly while, you know, head of the military command at NATO of, you know, world, particularly energy resources being a NATO concern. And he spoke not only of the Gulf of Guinea in West Africa, where the U.S. currently gets 15% of its oil, is anticipated shortly to get 25%. But also the Caspian Sea, of course, and this has a lot to do with the war in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, one thing that I think this shows that the Cold War was a lie, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, NATO moved closer. In other words, there was a reason. You could say that the Soviet Union was very ruthless in controlling Eastern Europe, but there was a reason for what they were doing. I mean, they were kind of setting up a protective ring of nations against invasion. And, you know, this shows that NATO, you know, as soon as the Soviet Union fell, NATO moved right up to the borders of Russia.
Yeah, you can really judge the character of a person or an organization by watching how they operate when there are no constraints on them. And I think there's a retroactive component to that, and you're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, there was an article I would recommend to your readers from January of this year by Edward Herman, who I'm sure your readers are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a tremendous, you know, concise but inclusive compendium. It's called NATO. It's an apt title, NATO, the Imperial Pit Bull.
Okay.
And, you know, if anyone wants to write to me, my email address is rwrozoff, R-O-Z-O-F-F, at yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can certainly send them that article. But what Herman does painstakingly is refute the entire contention that NATO ever was a defensive alliance. He states, you know, and I can remember when Mikhail Gorbachev went to Fulton, Missouri for the anniversary of Churchill's Iron Curtain speech and stated, frankly, there was not only a desire by the Soviet Union, which had, you know, lost 28 million people, its industrial base was devastated and so forth at the end of World War II, to launch an invasion or send tanks into Central Europe, but there wasn't the capacity. And that NATO, which was formed in, I believe, June of 1949, you know, anticipated the Warsaw Pact, which wasn't found until 1955, 6 years later, and that in response to bringing West Germany into the alliance. One should keep in mind that when NATO was founded in 1949, it was also the pretext for the U.S. to move nuclear weapons into Europe, where they remain. You know, their estimates are from 200 to 450 U.S. nuclear warheads stationed in NATO countries, including Turkey, which is not far from the Russian border, and that the Soviets didn't develop their atomic bomb until months after the founding of NATO.
Okay, we are talking with Rick Rozoff about a global version of NATO. And, you know, one thing occurs to me. Now, NATO has 28 members, 22 partners, and about 13 or so other, about 50, you know, total in the, you know, kind of in the club.
Yeah.
The UN has 192 members.
Mm-hmm.
So if NATO replaces the UN, that leaves out about 129 states. They are kind of out in the cold unless they want to join up with this new NATO on steroids.
Yeah, you put everything very well, but that particularly. The number, you know, by my count, is actually quite larger. At least a third of the world's nations have some kind of partnership arrangement and membership with or membership in NATO. There's something called the Mediterranean Dialogue, which is includes Algeria, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Mauritania, Morocco, Tunisia. There's the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, which includes the six states and the Gulf Cooperation Council in the Persian Gulf. Guess who they're targeted at? You know, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar. There's also a new category called contact countries, which include Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Japan. There are other kind of ad hoc partnerships with Afghanistan, Pakistan, I think increasingly India. So you're looking at a military bloc that went from 16 members in 1999 to members in partnerships that include probably at least a third of the world's nations at this point, and expanding.
So that leaves out two-thirds of the world's population. And if NATO is about kind of controlling vital resources, one would think these way over 100 nations would... they may not get, you know, they may be cut off from vital resources.
Oh, you're correct on that score. As a matter of fact, in late January, more or less as a parting shot, when George W. Bush left office, about a week and a half before, the White House published a National Security Directive on the Arctic, where the latest U.S. Geological Survey suggests that a third of the world's undiscovered natural gas and a quarter of the oil rest in the you know, the Arctic Circle. And U.S. made territorial, including military claims, to the Arctic Circle. But shortly thereafter, NATO held kind of an emergency meeting in Iceland, a conference on the High North or something to that effect, where they talked about navigation in the Arctic, particularly the Northwest Passage north of Canada, in the northern part of Canada, and also talked about resource wars. NATO increasingly has been talking about everything, water supplies, food supplies, cyber warfare. They have more than enough reason to wage 100 wars for 100 years, according to their own rationale. So again, you know, to back up your earlier claim, you know, to believe that NATO is a defensive alliance set up to prevent an imminent Soviet invasion was a charade to begin with, and we now see that they have global designs, and they quite openly trumpet them.
Well, let's get on to Afghanistan. There are NATO has its army fighting in Afghanistan. I think 45 nations, and maybe more than that by now. Are they under U.S. command? How does that operate?
It's very interesting. The United Nations, again, under Kofi Annan and Ban Ki-moon, have been as compliant as one could expect them to be. As a matter of fact, there was a secret arrangement reached with the then General Secretary of NATO, Yotta Hope-Scheffer, and Ban Ki-moon last September behind the backs of the UN Security Council, including Russia and China, you know, for joint UN-NATO operations globally. Currently, one Stanley McChrystal, U.S. general, is heading up both U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. The NATO troops serve under what's called, how's this for a euphemism, International Security Assistance Force, originally UN-sanctioned, was to have only operated in the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul. It's fanned out all through the country. Countries like Germany, which hasn't waged combat operations since World War II, Finland, the same thing, Sweden in 200 years, are engaged in active combat operations in northern Afghanistan. This is under NATO auspices. And I might mention about McChrystal because, you know, he had come to his position from the war in Iraq, and he was head of something called the Joint Special Operations Command, which is a counterinsurgency operation. That's why he replaced McKiernan in Afghanistan to really launch a Vietnam-style counterinsurgency organization. And somebody who wrote a book, somebody from the London Times, 3 years ago on the topic of this command called it, and this is a revealing title, Killer Elite, the Inside Story of America's Most Secret Special Operations.
Mm-hmm.
So McChrystal, the former head of that, is now jointly the commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, which have exceeded now 100,000 collectively, with more on the way.
Sound like a kind of a global version of Operation Phoenix, which operated in Vietnam.
It's a very close parallel. As a matter of fact, the NATO troops until recently, until they dropped the very last pretense of their being on a peacekeeping mission, have worked in what they call provincial reconstruction teams, you know, supposedly to do nice things in Afghan villages and so forth. In fact, you know, I call them provincial pacification teams.
Well, little fortified villages like they had in Vietnam.
That's it, exactly. That's the model.
Kind of like concentration camps, really. Well, you know, NATO seems to be in for a long war in Afghanistan. I mean, or they would like to be in for a long war. I kind of wonder if they can do it. But, you know, it's a drive to control Central Asia. And you have to ask, will China just sit back and let this happen? Or will China and Russia, you know, fight against it?
Yeah, that's a very puzzling question, and I think it's a complicated one. I've remarked that, you know, Russia and China expanded a previous regional security organization, which was then called the Shanghai Five, into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in June of 2001. It also includes four of the five former Soviet Central Asian republics, all except Turkmenistan. And 3 months, 3 months, 4 months after that, the U.S. and NATO invade Afghanistan. It almost looks as though one of the objectives of going into Afghanistan is to prevent the development of a regional security and economic bloc that would have included, as has been remarked, half the human race. That is, nations like India, China, Russia, Pakistan, Iran, the Central Asian republics, and others. And that is, it was exactly at that founding meeting of, it was perhaps a year or two later, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where they held a summit in Kazakhstan, and the president, Nazarbayev, actually addressed, you know, the representatives of the attendees by stating, you know, I'm addressing the representatives of half the human race. So one of the objectives in being not only in Afghanistan, incidentally, pair, but in surrounding areas, there are U.S. and NATO troops and warplanes stationed in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Pakistan itself, Kyrgyzstan. So they've really intruded themselves into a very vital part of the world and extremely close to the Caspian Sea, where, as I mentioned to you, our new Kissinger, James Jones, you know, was working on energy projects. And as a matter of fact, Donald Rumsfeld, who was defense secretary, openly mooted what he called a Caspian Guard, which would have been U.S. and allied military forces in the Caspian Sea. That would have been a direct threat to both Russia and Iran.
So basically, we are the U.S. is bankrupt. We're fighting these wars on borrowed money. And China, if they wanted to, they could kind of pull the plug on the dollar anytime.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's true, of course. But I think one of the reasons why, and to me it is a bit puzzling, but why nations like China and Russia are not only not opposing the U.S. and NATO military buildup in Afghanistan, but in some ways supporting it, is that we have to remember the aftermath of the first Afghan war. You know, estimates are that Operation Cyclone, which was a CIA operation to fund Mujahideen rebels inside Pakistan for attacks, you know, inside Afghanistan, is estimated to have been the largest CIA covert operation in history. You know, estimates go up to, you know, several tens of billions spent on this. And the major recipient of it was one Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who at one point in the 1980s was brought with his Mujahideen allies to the White House, met with Ronald Reagan, who referred to them as the equivalents of our founding fathers. And Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was quoted about 2 days ago in the press. He's now his forces are now working with Taliban, fighting U.S. and NATO forces. This is, you know, this is our creature, of course. But the aftermath of that was the destabilization of an entire region. And you had, you know, fighting in newly independent nations like Tajikistan and so forth shortly thereafter. So China, whose Xinjiang province has been in the news of late, as you know, the Russian North Caucasus, Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia, where there have been scores of killings over the last few months, this insurgency that the CIA armed, trained, and so forth, you know, metastasized. So that, in a way, the U.S. is able to blackmail, I suspect, countries like China and Russia, saying, you know, you support our attacking Taliban and alleged al-Qaeda forces in Pakistan and Afghanistan, or they're coming to get you.
Boy, well, it's a very fluid situation. You know, it brings to mind during the Korean War, we were warned against fighting a land war in Asia. And, you know, maybe China's letting us get bogged down. I don't know. That's one thing I thought about.
I've heard that theory about both Russian and Chinese perspectives. Kind of give us a dose of our own medicine.
You know, and then you get to, well, what we call peak oil. If oil gets really expensive, you know, like back up to $150 or $200 a barrel, you'd be fighting a resource war, burning up the resource you're fighting for. And without fairly cheap oil, you know, it seems to me these big armies are going to get totally bogged down.
That's a distinct possibility. I mean, Afghanistan could turn into a protracted, essentially endless conflict. As a matter of fact, it has all the hallmarks of exactly that. There are other, you know, factors involved. I mentioned, you know, AFRICOM, the Africa Command, which was centered on the Gulf of Guinea, you know, the oil-rich Gulf of Guinea. As a matter of fact, there's just a report a few days ago that some branch of the Pentagon had conducted simulated war games.
Oh, right. I think Somalia and Nigeria.
And openly talking about intervening in Nigeria and possibly deposing the government.
Oh, boy. I think we're going to have to leave it there. We were talking to Rick Rozoff about a global NATO. Do you have a where can people get more information?
Yeah, for the last decade, I've run an email news list called Stop NATO. Mm-hmm. It's a Yahoo group. The address is kind of hard, so I think better if they just write to me directly. And that's, again, rwrozoff@yahoo.com. And there's a daily digest option where you can get one email a day with sometimes up to 25 news stories. And all are invited. I'd be glad to sign people up. One last thing, though, on James Jones, our National Security Advisor, at the Munich Security Conference earlier this year, he began his speech, by the way, half tongue-in-cheek, but I think half seriously, by saying words to the effect, "I take orders from Henry Kissinger every day."
Oh, boy, the old Henry Kissinger. We haven't got rid of the old one yet. Okay, thank you, Rick Rozoff.
Thank you.
We will be continuing this in the future. Thanks a lot.